We're about to go into a dark winter.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. On this week's show, we remember how, during the fall of 1918, the Spanish flu roared back with a similar vengeance and similarly incoherent and inconsistent advice from state public health authorities.
There are people dying in 24 hours after the first symptoms. People very rapidly know they're being lied to. They lose all trust in authority. Rumor and panic spread.
Plus, how and why America has always claimed ownership of the work of Britain's very own Will Shakespeare.
It is explosive. It is potentially toxic. But that's why it speaks to us. We get it.
It's all coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is out this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. We have a lot of history coming up this hour. Some sweet, most sour. Pretty much all of it fascinating. And all tending to the inevitable conclusion, to paraphrase Samuel Beckett, that the sun shines, having no alternative, on the nothing new. We start with the specter still haunting us this Thanksgiving weekend.
Hospitalizations around the country have nearly doubled since late September. Some hospitals are already talking about rationing care.
New cases nearly triple the daily rate we were seeing just a few weeks ago. 44 states reporting a rise over the past week. Deaths also climbing.
We're about to go into a dark winter. A dark winter.
The murderous second wave is upon us. Just as the Spanish flu returned to menace us in the fall of 1918. Ultimately, that flu killed more than 50 million people worldwide, including at least 675,000 Americans. Yet President Woodrow Wilson never addressed the nation's loss in any way. The first wave to hit Europe's First World War battlefields was in the spring. Not wanting to look weak, the Germans, the British, the French, and nearly everyone else kept mum. About all this and more, we spoke earlier this year to John Barry, author of The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. He told us it was only covered by newspapers in neutral Spain, which in fact is how the flu got its name.
Spain was not at war, so it didn't censor its press. Plus, the king himself got sick, so there was a lot of press about it, and it got the name Spanish flu. It was well established elsewhere before it ever arrived in Spain.
We do know that it spread on our shores out of control from a military base outside of Boston, right?
That was the first place that the second wave hit in the United States. I mean, the virus clearly changed. In the first wave, it was generally mild. There were actually medical journal articles saying this looks and smells like influenza, but it's not killing enough people, so it's probably not influenza.
There was a mutation between the first and second wave?
Almost certainly. I mean, we can't prove that through molecular biology, but epidemiologically, it seems quite certain.
Between 50 million and 100 million people worldwide were infected, that would equal, if you adjusted for population, somewhere between 200 and 400 million today, 675,000 killed in the U.S.
Right. An estimated 28% of the U.S. population was sick.
The second wave was the deadliest here. It was in the fall of 1918, right at the end of the war. But what would we have seen if we'd cracked open a local newspaper in autumn 1918?
Lots of war coverage, but very little about the pandemic. Wilson had created something called the Committee for Public Information, a propaganda arm, and the architect for that committee said truth and falsehood are arbitrary terms. It matters very little if it is true or false. So that was the attitude of the government propaganda machine. It also had passed a law making it punishable with 20 years in jail to, quote, utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, scurrilous, profane, or abusive language about the form of government of the United States.
This was the Sedition Act of 1918, right?
Yeah. A congressman was sentenced to more than 10 years in jail under that act, so publishers were threatened with it. Wilson himself, at one point, told a cousin, thank God, for Abraham Lincoln. I won't make the mistakes he made allowing the free press to flourish during the Civil War.
But Lincoln closed 300 newspapers.
Plenty of negative press about him in the re-election campaign of 1864. And again, going back to that Committee of Public Information, the guy who ran that, George Creel, wanted to create, quote, one white-hot mass with fraternity, devotion, courage, and deathless determination. They really tried to make Americans conform, have one way of thinking. I don't think we've ever experienced that before or since, more than the McCarthy period, more than any of the Red Scares. The press was determined to be as patriotic as anyone. For example, the Cleveland Plain Dealer wrote, "What the nation demands is that treason, whether thinly veiled or quite unmasked, be stamped out." I could go on and give you other examples. You know, you had on the one hand the carrot, the idea that the press was supposed to be patriotic and inspire people to help in the war effort. And on the other hand, you had the stick of that Sedition Act. So the result, as a general rule, was a very cooperative, complacent press where there was, in fact, fake news because they were cooperating with the government line.
But all this intensity was also employed to muzzle coverage of the flu.
Exactly. There was a concern that any negative news, no matter what it was about, would damage the war effort by hurting morale.
But surely there were exceptions. The Jefferson County Union paper in Wisconsin you've talked about?
Correct. When the pandemic hit there and they started to tell the truth about it, they were threatened with prosecution under the Sedition Act. There was no Tony Fauci back then. One national public health leader, quoted by the Associated Press, said this is ordinary influenza by another name. Another said the so-called Spanish influenza is nothing more or less than old-fashioned grip.
That sounds a little familiar.
Yeah. A few miles outside Little Rock was Camp Pike. 8,000 soldiers were admitted to the hospital in 4 days. The camp commandant stopped releasing the names of the dead. A doctor there wrote a colleague, "Every corridor, and there are miles of them, have a double row of cots with influenza patients. There is only death and destruction." The camp called upon Little Rock to supply civilian doctors and nurses and linens and coffins. And the Arkansas Gazette, just a few miles away, in its headline writes, quote, "Spanish influenza is playing the grip, same old fever and chills." You have essentially the same thing happening everywhere. Des Moines, Iowa, for example, the city attorney was part of the emergency committee running the response to influenza. He wrote publishers, quote, "I would recommend that if anything be printed in regard to the disease, it be confined to simple preventative measures, something constructive rather than destructive," unquote. And of course, you know, that carried with it the potential for prosecution.
What was constructive? What was destructive in this formulation?
Public health guidance, such as keep your windows open, avoid crowds, washing your hands, things like that, that would be considered constructive. Actually, printing news of what was happening was destructive.
You also had remarkable details about the Espionage Act that involved the post office.
Right, and the postmaster was not going to allow anything negative, and what they regard as negative was actually just the truth in many occasions, anything that they regarded as depressing to morale. Back then, of course, many of the news media was distributed solely through the mail, so that effectively was completely silencing publishers, effectively putting them out of business.
It would seem to be a terrifying time to be an American.
It was a violent, terrifying disease. People could turn so dark blue from lack of oxygen. The book I quoted, one physician writing a colleague, that he couldn't distinguish African-American soldiers from white soldiers because their pallor was so similar. In some camps, 15% of the soldiers with the disease had a nosebleed. But you could also bleed from your mouth, and you could bleed even from your eyes and ears. And when they are being told that this is ordinary influenza by another name, there are people dying 24 hours after the first symptoms. People very rapidly know they're being lied to. They lose all trust in authority. rumor and panic spread. It leads to a fraying of society, and worst cases, almost a breakdown of society.
You contrast the cities of Philadelphia and San Francisco.
Philadelphia may be the most extreme example. Literally, thousands of people are dying, and they finally belatedly closed schools and bars and theaters and so forth, and finally took this act. One of the Philadelphia newspapers actually said, quote, "This is not a public health measure. You have no cause for panic or alarm," unquote. Beyond absurd. Of course, you're not going to believe anything you read either in that paper or any paper. In Philadelphia, society really did almost begin to break down. There are reports of people starving to death because no one had the courage to bring them food. In San Francisco, by contrast, the mayor, medical leaders in the community, the business leaders, the trade union leaders all signed a joint statement in huge type in the newspaper, full page, said, "Wear a mask and save your life." It turns out those masks were not very useful, but that is a very, very different message than "this is ordinary influenza" with another name. San Francisco functioned. It seemed to come together when schools closed. Teachers volunteered, even as ambulance drivers, which, of course, is a pretty risky thing to do. Compare that to Philadelphia, where people could starve to death because nobody had the courage to bring them food. I think it's directly related to the fact that people were told the truth and the leadership trusted the public. Both Philadelphia and San Francisco were extremely hard hit by the disease. San Francisco was right around fifth in the country in terms of excess mortality, which was about the same as Philadelphia. But in one city, you can see an absolute fraying of society. And in the other city, you see the community coming together and helping each other.
Woodrow Wilson got the flu. It resulted in intense disorientation, a decreased mental functioning that was a symptom of this particular pandemic at the absolutely wrong time.
You know, it was widely noted that people did become extremely disoriented and in some cases psychotic, then recovered. And, you know, Wilson got sick at Paris while negotiating the peace treaty. Everybody around him, from Irwin Hoover, who was the White House usher, to Herbert Hoover, commented on how they had never seen him like this. His mind wasn't functioning. German territories were essentially ceded to France. France was allowed to economically exploit German regions. Germany was saddled with huge reparations payments. And essentially every historian of the rise of the Nazis credits or blames that peace treaty for part of the rise of Hitler and subsequently World War II. John Maynard Keynes called Wilson the greatest fraud on earth after that peace conference.
The greatest fraud on earth. Wilson never, ever spoke about the flu, though, did he? We look at newspaper accounts. Those are muzzled and confused. What were you able to find about how people understood what was happening or how they mourned the dead or tried to protect themselves?
There was a very serious scientist named Victor Vaughan, who during the war became a colonel, head of the Communicable Disease Division for the Army. And right at the height, he wrote, "If the current rate of acceleration continues for a few more weeks, civilization could easily disappear from the face of the earth." That is how bad it was beginning to get. And he happened to write that right at the peak, and things began to improve.
What about the artists, the novelists? We know Katherine Ann Porter wrote Pale Horse, Pale Rider, but there doesn't seem to be a lot written by observers, even by survivors.
You know, that has always puzzled me, the lack of literature about this. Nonetheless, it is clearly out there in the public mind. Christopher Isherwood was in Berlin. He wrote Berlin Stories, from which the great movie Cabaret came. Mm-hmm. When the Nazis entered Berlin, he said you could feel it like influenza in your bones. this kind of sense of deep dread. And this is 15 years after the pandemic. You certainly expected his readers to recognize dread that he was referring to. So it was out there, even if people weren't writing about it.
There was a period of generations where there was nary a mention of the epidemic. I don't think I was an exception to the rule. We knew more about the bubonic plague than we knew about the 1918 pandemic. How do you account for that?
You know, it was so fast. That's part of it. Probably two-thirds of the deaths worldwide occurred in a period of 14 or 15 weeks. And in any given community, it was roughly half that length of time. The influenza would hit a city, and 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks later, it was gone. You know, there may have been a third wave, depending where that city was. That would come months later, and the third wave was still lethal enough, but it was nothing compared to the second wave. You had this incredible brevity, and life largely returned to normal pretty quickly. And it was ending almost simultaneously with the end of the war. November 11th, people are out celebrating practically to the moment in many cities that they were coming out of their lockdown. As I'm talking now, I can sort of see part of the forgetfulness, except for those who had personally suffered. Two-thirds of the dead were people aged 18 to 45, and the elderly hardly suffered at all. But kids under the age of 5 died at a rate equal today to all-cause mortality for a period of 23 years. Just think of that. Kids dying today from all causes over a period of 23 years. Compress that into a period of a few weeks in 1918 and think of the toll that would take on parents.
But I have to ask you, 675,000 dead in the U.S., adjusted for population, that would be 2 million?
Yeah.
And yet, when it was over, was there ever a moment of national mourning? Was there ever a monument erected to the dead? Was there ever a recognition of the immense tragedy?
In terms of individual recollection, yes. I remember telling my aunt, who was about 10 years old during the pandemic, what I was doing, and she essentially grasped her chest, practically started crying. So it was not something forgotten by individuals, that tragedy. As a society, no. I've thought about this for 20 years and I haven't got a decent explanation.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
John Barry is the author of The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History, and professor at Tulane's School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. We first aired that interview in phase one. Coming up, something new and completely different. Shakespeare's rough and ready relationship with American history. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone on this unusual Thanksgiving weekend. Today, the global pandemic leaves us with little to imagine but plague. On the less dark side, we hear how Isaac Newton, waiting out London's plague year of 1665 in forced isolation on his family farm, made stunning scientific breakthroughs. And the name of William Shakespeare trended because we were reminded that he wrote King Lear while quarantined. But writing in the New York Times in March, Emma Smith argued that much of his life was marred by plague, and self-isolating while writing Lear wouldn't have been a unique experience. In fact, Smith suggests, Shakespeare probably wrote most of his plays amid the threat of infectious disease. And yet, the theme of plague pops up relatively rarely in his work. So, taking a page out of the Bard's playbook, we at the show are going to interrupt our regularly scheduled doom and gloom to talk about Shakespeare, namely, how he became a staple of American cultural and political life. James Shapiro is a professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. His most recent book is Shakespeare in a Divided America, What His Plays Tell Us About Our Past and Future. James, welcome back to OTM.
It is a pleasure.
So, who owns Shakespeare? That's a big question you raise early and often in your book. It's a tension you trace back to the very beginning of American history.
Everybody stakes a claim in Shakespeare, going back to 1776 and even a few years before then. Those on both sides of the cultural divide, whatever the cultural divide at that moment was, reached out to Shakespeare, enlisted him in their cause.
John Adams said that the history plays were a roadmap to where we were heading. The treachery, perfidy, treason, murder, cruelty, sedition, and rebellions of rival and unbalanced factions.
Could you imagine writing that in a letter to your son, the future sixth president of the United States? But he did. And John Adams was looking around, and he saw an America that was divided, that was factionalized, that was at risk. And he imagined one day, and he even did a riff on Henry V in this imagining, one day we would have a president of the United States put in power by a foreign despot or dictator who had some kind of economic control over him. The divisions that splinter us today have been there from the founding of our republic, as has Shakespeare.
In 1877, a columnist in the New York Herald declared that Shakespeare was an American hero.
You would think that having broken from Britain in 1776 and then went on to fight another war with them, that we would not adopt as our national poet, England's national poet. But in fact, we have. There's not an American writer, not Hemingway, not Emily Dickinson, not Faulkner, who is named as required reading by American high school and junior high school students. Shakespeare is.
Why do you think that is?
We want to believe that what started in England ended in America. We keep wanting to rip or wrest Shakespeare away from the English who don't appreciate him, who don't value him.
How do they make that argument?
We have a lot more Globe theaters or imitation Globe theaters in our country than they do in Britain. We have far more Shakespeare summer festivals here. There's really a determined effort to make Shakespeare fully American, sometimes in really disturbing ways, sometimes in just plain humorous ways.
So let's talk about immigration and race and difference generally, because in Shakespeare's comedies, which are actually any of the plays that have a happy ending, sort of, you note that the marginalized are always the losers.
One of the ways in which Shakespeare has made himself really useful to those who want to weaponize him is through the structure of his comedies. I mean, we all love the way they end in marriage and communal celebration, but that community at the end of all these joyous plays is premised on somebody being kept out. You define yourself by who you don't admit. So whether it's Shylock at the end of The Merchant of Venice, or Jaques in As You Like It, or Caliban, who's not allowed to go back with everybody to Italy at the end of The Tempest, or Malvolio at the end of Twelfth Night. Mm-hmm. You define who's in by determining who's kept out, mocking them, and excluding them. What better way to define who's an American than along this model that is time-tested through Shakespearean comedy?
Pause for a moment at Caliban in The Tempest, this beastly figure who, in a 1916 production, is a stand-in for the unwashed immigrants.
Yeah, those are my grandparents, I suppose, on both sides, living on the Lower East Side, who are called by sociologists of the day kind of Caliban figures. Just look at their faces, look at their shoulders as they go to and from the sweatshops.
Sometimes am I all wound with adders, with cloven tongues do hiss me into madness.
Caliban is, in the late 19th century, increasingly seen as a Darwinian missing link, half man, half beast. And he became a kind of metaphor or stand-in for those who were not fully accepted into white Anglo-Saxon American culture. A very talented playwright named Percy MacKaye wrote this great Mask of Caliban, Caliban by the Yellow Sand. And the Caliban figure was supposed to be somebody who was educated successfully into American culture, if you will. Except every 15 or 20 minutes he tries to assault or rape Miranda. He's incorrigible. Even as this was being staged, it undermined its message of acceptance and only underscored that America could not absorb the Calibans of this world.
Now, Othello is no comedy, but he reverberates through history. You recalled that John Quincy Adams, who was well known as an abolitionist, had a surprisingly visceral distaste for Othello.
It's the saddest chapter in my book. Othello is a fundamental American play. Its history here is completely different from its history in England. In England in 1825, an African-American was actually performing the role of Othello on the London stage. But it would be over 100 years before Paul Robeson could do the same on Broadway.
My wife? What wife? I have no wife. Oh, insupportable. Oh, heavy heart. Methinks it should be now a huge eclipse of sun and moon, and that the affrighted globe should yawn at alteration.
The story of John Quincy Adams is the story of my book, which has as its argument, Americans are really not good at talking with each other about things they disagree vehemently about or things they don't want to admit about themselves. John Quincy Adams, as you say, great abolitionist, fought the Amistad case in front of the Supreme Court after he served as America's sixth president, joined the House of Representatives to fight slavery. And yet, he could not wrap his head around the idea of a white woman sleeping with a black guy. Just could not do it. He was invited to what turned out to be the worst dinner party in history. He was seated next to the superstar British actress Fanny Kemble, and he spent the evening mansplaining Shakespeare to her, including saying that Othello was disgusting.
And the person most to blame in the play is Desdemona.
Absolutely. She doesn't respect male authority, and she marries a black guy. And John Quincy Adams says, in getting kind of strangled and smothered to death at the end, she got what she deserved. Mm-hmm. What do you think when one of the great opponents of slavery is actually thinking this stuff? And of course, many people think this stuff, but they don't say it or write it. And after that terrible dinner party, she went home, wrote up her notes, and 2 years later published the conversation. He, mortified, writes this essay on the character of Desdemona, trashing her for falling in love and marrying a black guy. He just couldn't understand why everybody didn't kind of go along and accept his view. And it appeared in major periodicals, and he wrote two essays saying this, in fact. The real shocker was Fanny Kemble wrote a letter that was later published to a friend in which she quotes Adams using the N-word to describe Othello. And I just can't believe it. You want to imagine a kind of more pristine American past. One of the ways of learning what we weren't taught about American history in high school is through how we talk about Shakespeare.
In your chapter on Manifest Destiny, when the nation embarked on exploiting or exterminating non-white people coast to coast, you observed an interesting evolution in the notion of masculinity, one that played out both in that policy and in the productions of Romeo and Juliet.
If you look at the American stage at this time, the model of what a man should be, which is sober and serious, hardworking, is replaced by a blustery, aggressive, heavily sexualized, violent type. The upshot of this was, when it came to casting Romeo, every guy who was trying to play that role failed in it. Because at some points in the play, he has to be, as Shakespeare calls him, effeminate.
Then I defy you, stars!
And at other times, he has to pick up a sword and kill Tybalt and be really kind of masculine. So women began taking over the part. 20 women played Romeo at this time, and the greatest of them was Charlotte Cushman. It tells you something about changing roles of masculinity when only a lesbian can play Romeo successfully in America. The most amazing thing I stumbled on in writing and researching this book was on the eve of the Mexican-American War, when 4,000 American troops are gathered on the border to cross the Rio Grande, and the officers decided to build a theater and put on plays with all-male casts. And one of the first plays they did was Othello. And they couldn't find somebody to play Desdemona.
And then they found this rather slight, pretty young officer.
Who looked great in a dress. Ulysses S. Grant. This is kind of pre-$50 bill grizzled Grant. He was girlish in those days. The guy playing Othello couldn't get up enough emotional excitement. They sent to New Orleans for a professional actress to sub for Grant, who went on to bigger and better things. But it was great to think of a future American president playing a woman in love with a black man. I mean, that tells you something about where this country has been.
British portrayals of Shakespeare protagonists, especially Macbeth and Hamlet, were very different from the American portrayals.
Do not muse at me, my most worthy friends. I have a strange infirmity.
True, in part because the lead American actor at this time, a guy named Forrest.
Edwin Forrest.
When they found him finally at the end of his career, dead in bed, they found a pair of hand weights at the foot of his bed. He was one of the early advocates of the pumped-up actor. He was the first great homegrown male Shakespearean actor. And he defined it in opposition to that kind of thoughtful, brooding, reflective English Shakespearean.
Am I a coward? Who calls me villain? Breaks my pater cross, plucks off my beard and blows it in my face, tweaks me by the nose, gives me the lie of the throat as deep as to the lungs. Who does me this?
Macbeth and Hamlet, who we just heard, were portrayed as warriors in America. They even cut the parts where they looked weak out of the plays. And that brings us to Lincoln's assassination.
John Wilkes Booth is notorious as the man who assassinated Lincoln at Ford's Theater in April 1865, but he was also one of the great Shakespeare actors of his day.
John Wilkes Booth played Macbeth, what, about 100 times? But it was the character of Brutus in Julius Caesar that seems to have been the true inspiration for what he did.
He loved the character of Brutus, as many in 19th century America did. This is a man who opposed tyranny, and the South saw Lincoln as a tyrant. Booth only acted once in this play, but he recited the speeches all the time. After assassinating Lincoln, he leaped onto the stage, a little leaping trick he stole from his Macbeth productions, and he shouted, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus always with tyrants, playing momentarily the part of an American Brutus right after his assassination of Lincoln.
Talk about the very controversial production of Julius Caesar you were involved in a few years back, put on by the Public Theater in Central Park. It roiled the political right.
Conservative protesters disrupt a controversial performance of Julius Caesar in New York City.
Are you a sad progressive who dreams about President Trump being knifed to death? Well, you're in luck. A new production of Julius Caesar in New York will let you live out your fantasy.
Caesar was dressed like Trump, had certain of his mannerisms, plus a wife, Calpurnia, who sported a Slavic accent. And of course, he's murdered in cold blood. Can you blame the right for being upset?
I don't blame the right for being upset any more than I would blame the left for being upset with, a year or so earlier, Rob Melrose's production of Julius Caesar that had an Obama lookalike assassinated on stage. The tradition of Julius Caesar in this country changed permanently when Orson Welles staged this play in 1937 at the Mercury Theater.
If there be any in this assembly, any dear friend of Caesar's, to him I say that Brutus's love to Caesar was no less than his. If then that friend demand why Brutus rose against Caesar, this is my answer. Not that I loved Caesar less, but that I loved Rome more.
His Caesar was just like Mussolini, and he completely politicized how this play was done. It became a template for how we did Caesar after that. Oscar Eustace, the artistic director of the Public Theater, he wanted to show that saving democracy by undemocratic means, like killing a Trump-like Caesar, was a greater disaster than anything else. I think he wanted to create a sense of whiplash in that liberal audience at the Delacorte Theater. And one of the ways he did that was to have 50 actors hidden throughout the audience so that when Brutus and the conspirators kill the Trump-like Caesar, they're screaming, they're yelling, they're castigating him for doing that, they're calling him out. The problem was when real protesters followed the fake protesters, audience members didn't know where the protests were coming from or who was protesting what. So that invasion, if you will, of the Delacorte by protesters who were paid to disrupt the show ruined the possibility of conversation and dialogue. Or maybe we're just not ready yet for conversation and dialogue in this country.
But Shakespeare does seem to be used like the Bible, in the sense that anyone can find a defense for whatever they believe in his text. Do you think his message, his intentions, his morals were more explicit in Elizabethan times, in the times they were written?
I don't think so, and I think that's why we still turn to Shakespeare. Shakespeare presents America's worst nightmares, the assassination of a ruler, a black man sleeping with a white woman, a Jew cutting the pound of flesh from a Christian. This is not the stuff in the Bible. And when we stage these things, we're forced to confront the stuff we don't really like confronting as Americans. It's right in our face.
James Shapiro, author of Shakespeare in a Divided America. Coming up on the relatively lighter side, the bard's use and abuse in American sexual politics. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. There's a fair amount of hanky-panky in Shakespeare's plays. Cross-dressing, animal attraction, but very little sex. Maybe Romeo and Juliet. There's passionate but platonic same-sex love. In his day, same-sex sex was a capital offense. The sexuality of Shakespeare himself is a matter of speculation. There's plenty of sexual politics in his plays, though. We see women sometimes defending, sometimes demeaning themselves. We see men sometimes punished for their greed or vanity or cruelty, sometimes not. In The Taming of the Shrew, fortune-hunting Petruchio is prone to all three, yet he succeeds in starving and bullying unwilling, ill-tempered Kate into apparent submission. In the musical takeoff, Kiss Me, Kate, two divorced actors find themselves playing Kate and Petruccio, and once again, the rascal has his way, on stage and backstage. James Shapiro is one of our leading bards of the bard, so let's start with the original.
Boy, that's a radioactive story. I mean, it ends with a woman putting her hand beneath her husband's foot.
Great, my reason happy more to bandy word for word and frown for frown. But now I see our lances are but straws. Come and place your hands below your husband's foot, in token of which duty, if he please. My hand is ready. May it do him ease.
Could you describe the evolution of Kiss Me, Kate, from Taming of the Shrew?
From 1941 to 45, American women are told, become Rosie the Riveter, enter the workforce, become independent financially and personally.
You observe that at some point, it's really common in film and movies and on stage to depict a woman being spanked. And it changed practically over the course of a few months.
Women are told by the government, get out of the way, become the happy housewife. And if your husband's going to beat you, just grin and bear it. And I'm really not exaggerating. Kiss Me, Kate is written at that moment. And at the center of it is something that was never in Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew, being spanked on stage. And spanking a woman is not only domestic violence, but it turns her into a child in a very explicit way.
It was on all the posters.
Oof, and it was in the New York Times when they reviewed it. That's the image from this play that stuck.
Now, there is a warring couple playing the two leads, Kate in Shakespeare's play. She's too much of a shrew for anyone to actually want to marry, so she's auctioned off to this guy passing through named Petruccio. The backstage story seems to follow similarly, at least the woman decides it is the better part of valor to simply bow to her husband's will, wink, wink, nod, nod, or maybe not. You tell a very interesting story about Cole Porter, who found himself with an almost intractable conundrum.
You know, the two great collaborative geniuses behind this musical, one is Bella Spiewak, one of the two women writing Broadway plays at this time, and the other is the great lyricist Cole Porter. This is a hard story to tell. Front stage, you have this restaging of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. Backstage, you have gang members collecting debts, divorce. There are white people, there are black people. It's kind of like real life backstage. And front stage is this artificial Shakespearean world. And they couldn't figure out how to end the play. And they bring out a couple of gangsters to sing a rousing song, Brush Up Your Shakespeare, which people love. And it's the finale of the whole musical as well. And it's a song about basically justifying domestic violence.
If your girl is a Washington Heights dream, treat the kid to a midsummer's night dream. If she fights when her clothes you are mussing, what a clothes much ado about nothing. If she says your behavior is heinous, kick her right in the Coriolanus.
You know, 5 years after this brilliant stage version, Kiss Me, Kate became a movie that was completely sanitized, and all the African-American stuff is removed, and the story in which a woman has real choices is, by the early 1950s, a story in which women no longer have choices.
I trow, and they'll all
So now take us through the strange and perilous journey that was the multiple Oscar-winning film Shakespeare in Love.
And I leave to be if I be not...
Take off your hat.
My hat?
Where'd you learn how to do that?
I...
Let me see you. Take off your hat.
Are you Master Shakespeare?
Wait there! Wait there!
The first script of Shakespeare in Love was written by a screenwriter named Mark Norman. And he, building upon what we know about Shakespeare from the sonnets and much else, imagined a Shakespeare who's married to Anne Hathaway, but who discovers himself falling in love with another man and comes to terms with that. It was way too far ahead of what Hollywood thought Americans were ready for. So they brought in Tom Stoppard, the greatest English playwright, Czech-born, but he's British. Then he gets rid of the gay stuff, and the infamous Harvey Weinstein is the producer trying to bring this thing to the point where it's going to win a gazillion Academy Awards. He's leaning on the director and he's leaning on Stoppard to fix the ending because Americans don't like adultery. And Harvey Weinstein's ideas turn the female lead, the Gwyneth Paltrow character, into a woman you keep on the side and throw parts to in exchange for sex. Or in other words, turn this into the Harvey Weinstein story. And Stoppard luckily resisted that. And the final film version gave Americans just what they wanted.
If I could write the beauty of her eyes, I was born to look in them and know myself.
And her lips?
Her lips? The early morning rose would wither on the branch if it could feel envy.
And her voice, like lark's song?
Deeper, softer. None of your twittering larks. I would banish nightingales from her garden before they interrupt her song.
Ah, oh, she sings too.
Constantly.
You also talk about who gets to perform Shakespeare. What does colorblind, genderblind casting mean in the current American context?
To be fully American is to be able to be in a Shakespeare play. And one of the most poignant stories I came across while researching this book was a short story by Toshio Mori, a Japanese-American who was born in the Bay Area and was moved at the beginning of the Second World War, like many Japanese-Americans, to the Topaz Relocation Camp in Utah. And he writes a story called Japanese Hamlet about a young Japanese man whose only desire in life is to play Hamlet. And nobody can bring themselves to tell him, it ain't gonna happen. It's another way of getting at who we really think is fully American.
Is there any one way that Shakespeare's texts can serve as a framework for historical memory?
I think they help us see what has been airbrushed out of the story we like to tell ourselves. And I actually think Shakespeare is a terrific force for good. I speak with a lot of people who are conservatives who love Shakespeare. I speak with a lot of people who are liberals who love Shakespeare. There's not a lot we actually can talk about and share in this country. I like to think that if we are going to do some healing in a post-coronavirus world, theaters as they were for Shakespeare, who lived through an age of plague, they're places where people flock to after trauma. And I'm hoping that they are going to provide some kind of clarity and solace as we put our nation back together again.
It's funny you said, you know, people on the right love Shakespeare and people on the left love Shakespeare. And you'd expect that of something that was blandly, broadly appealing. And yet, it's quite the reverse. His body of work is almost combustible.
It is, and that's the great secret of Shakespeare. It is explosive, it is potentially toxic, but that's why it speaks to us. We get it.
Thank you so much.
It is always so much fun speaking with you.
James Shapiro is the author of Shakespeare in a Divided America, What His Plays Tell Us About Our Past and Future. And that's the show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova Burgess, Micah Lowinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Eloise Blondio, with help from Ava Sassani. Zandra Ellen wrote our newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Adrian Lilly and Josh Hahn. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And have a happy Thanksgiving.